sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Coca-Cola does a monster deal. It's a weird week of war worries. Crude breaks $96 during the week. And we have lots more to talk about on the eco and earnings front. All this and much more on episode number 377 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, thanks to the band for that great blues intro. Of course, we have a live band here at every single time we do the show, and they're just great. Gotta love it. Anyway, it's Andrew Horowitz. How are you? How was your week? How was your weekend? I just got back from dropping my son off at University of Central Florida, an amazingly large school. It's interesting. I didn't know this maybe a couple of years back, but now definitely. It is the number two school in the United States in terms of size, 60,000 students that go there. I think the number one is University of Arizona, if I'm not mistaken. But think about that. Just incredible that universities and you know have that many people that are actually attending. Now, mind you, probably there's about 10,000 or so, maybe a little bit less, that are online. But still, that goes into the statistics to give you the total amount and number of students that are studying there. But really quite incredible, especially since I was younger and probably the same thing for you, that there has been this change in the requirement in terms of education when it comes to getting a job in the future. Of course, you know, you kind of go way back and you look at, what was it? Let's see, apprenticeships and learning on the job. And that was okay for a while. People were doing well. You learn under somebody and maybe you get into their business, stay with them for a long period of time and learn their various techniques, the tools, the processes. But now you need a college education. So it's kind of an interesting turn of affairs that we've seen over the last number of years. Who knows how this is affecting us in terms of the, you know, the unemployment rate. Now it's 6.2%, excuse me. And, you know, what's going to be for the prospect? You hear a lot of times that right now there are a lot of job openings and a lot of people that are not qualified or overqualified. Seems like there's no longer a certain amount of education that you have to have. You have to be much more specialized. That's what it was like when you had an apprenticeship, right? You had way back, I'm talking now, where you had maybe a skill. Maybe you were a blacksmith. You studied under somebody, you worked with them for years, and now for whatever reason that business is gone or you've moved on and you moved away and you're looking for another job, well, what's your skill set? Well, you're a blacksmith. So you look for a job, but for whatever reason in this community, there's no need. So you're really not able to, through your educational process, find something that fits your particular specialty. Now, it's a little bit broader now. You have education and the education gives you a broad brush maybe of business or, you know, maybe you're going to be in the sciences or whatever particular area that you're in. But still, if you think about it, we've gone through a period where you were very specialized, very general, and back to being very specialized. And that's some of the problem we're having in the jobs market in the United States. Well, okay, with that, it's good because we're seeing that corporations are able to run a lot more leaner. We've seen this. We've seen that the technology, the advancements, the re-engineering of a company, and all the things that go into the manufacturing process and robotics, et cetera. People said 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when we had been talking about this, that it was a lot of malarkey. It is playing out exactly as we had anticipated. The fact of the matter is that companies can work and produce at the same levels they had in the past with much fewer employees. Now, the opposite side of that and the reaction and effect of that is that, well, you're going to see that there's going to be fewer dollars spent overall because you have less people that are working. And we're seeing that through the retail sales numbers. We're seeing that through the overall CPI. We have a low CPI, low inflation rate. PPI came in last week, matched expectations at about 0.2 on the headline number compared to 0.2, which was the expected. So that's really not a big deal. Remember something. Last month when we saw the PPI come out, it was pretty hot. There was a real concern that inflation was finally starting to kick in with all this amount of stimulus that was not only pumped in by the Fed, but by the world's central banks creating artificial money out of thin air, essentially dropping the value of their currency. And the big question was, when are we going to see inflation? When are we going to see that there's going to be this rampant inflation that we've been anticipating for years? Now, if you recall, we've had some discussion about this. A few weeks back, we had a behavioral expert in terms of behavioral finance and talked about how everybody's thinking that this should be the case because that had been the case, but yet at the same time, there was a lot of differences this time around than we had seen in the past. Now, while there are many of us that think that, okay, well, if we see X happen, well, the opposite side and the reaction side has to be Y. That's not always the case. Not always the case at all, as a matter of fact. We see that, for example, markets don't even have more than a, I don't know, two-day, three-day mindset that is concerning towards war and political and geopolitical unrest. For example, we saw that not last week, but the week before, markets swooned pretty well on the fact that there was fighting in the Middle East and Ukraine, and there was political problems throughout not only the Middle East, but also we're starting to see things in Libya, and it goes on, the list of things that are happening. And this week that we came into, which was options expiration week, all of a sudden, okay, things are fine. You know what? Wow. Russia is doing humanitarian aid to the Ukraine and to the, they're going to put money and supplies into the area. But did we really believe that? Or we wanted to believe that. Maybe we wanted to believe that. I think that was more so much more of what was going on in the beginning of the week, because on Friday, while we saw markets start to creep up, we saw a relatively, like I said, benign PPI number. Retail sales were definitely soft for the week. There was really nothing going on that was earth-shattering in terms of changes. Oil prices were coming down a bit, and that's good, supposedly, for the economy. Remember something, we talk about this crazy situation where economists and investors and the pundits and the television and radio talkers will talk about how when there is an increase in fuel prices, it magically doesn't have an effect on consumers' pocketbooks. It doesn't have an effect on their spending, their mentality about what's happening. But yet, when oil prices come down and followed by gasoline prices, which did drop again, somehow, magically, it's amazing, that's good. That seems to be good for the economy. Now, I'll tell you something. I agree that the fact is that when we have lower costs for fuel and other items, maybe food, that's good for the economy because you'll see that discretionary spending will increase. That makes all the sense in the world. You agree with that, right? Of course. But we have to also take the other side of it. We have to realize that when there is an increase in costs, whether it's for food, energy, or any other goods, insurance, etc., there is going to be a constraint put upon a consumer who is used to spending X dollars and now has X dollars minus the increase in costs that now are occurring in the economy. Keep that in mind. Especially keep that in mind because we have this week plenty of retails companies that are going to be putting out earnings. For example, let me get my list. I have a good list of key earnings that are coming out this week. So we're going to start off the week on the 19th, which is Tuesday. And this is going to be before the markets open. We have Home Depot coming out. Now, Home Depot is a benchmark for consumer spending, as well as the fact that it is a good read-through on what's going on with the housing market. You realize that when we look at the housing market and we look at existing home sales, and I can tell you this as someone who now has nightly trips to Home Depot. sometimes twice or three times a day on the weekends because I bought a house. We're doing some remodeling. So the contractors are there. Sometimes they need a little bit of something and I say, okay, I'll go get it. Sometimes I'm doing something, a little bit of handiwork, very little handiwork. And I'll go to Home Depot, a little part here, part there. I need the main water valve in the house, a little bit of a leak. Okay, we'll pick up that and we'll get the piping and we'll get, oh, you know what? Got to go back because we need a new gas filter for something or some kind of something for the dryer or whatever it may be. But this is something that goes on a regular basis in an economy that as you own a home, obviously, but also when you're buying a new home or buying an existing home, there's oftentimes much more remodeling, redecorating, fixing up, all these different things that go into it that sometimes will be done by a contractor who, by the way, may in fact use a Home Depot or a Lowe's rather than maybe some other hardware supply store because Home Depot is really both for the retail and the professional. So you'll see that Home Depot sales will follow the housing market. They're expected before the market. Expectations are for $1.44. Keep that on your radar, $1.44. We're also going to see the same day, and I think this is important, because this was a real negative number last time, and it was Dick's. Dick's Sporting Goods is going to be out on the 19th as well, before the market opens. 66 cents is the analyst expectation. We have TGX coming out also on that same day, 73 cents. And then on the 20th, we have Target. We have, let's see what else we have. Lowe's, Staples, American Eagle. Let's see, we have Staples looking for about 11 cents. Lowe's looking for $1 per share. We have, let's see, that PetSmart at 93 cents. Target, 78 cents. I don't know if you can write these down fast enough to kind of put those on your watch list. We also have on the 21st coming out, Gap. We have Ross Stores. We have GameStop. Dollar Tree, Aeropostale, Shield, or Sears. And then on the 22nd, we have both Ann and Foot Locker. So this week is going to be a pretty important week when it comes to looking at the actual earnings versus expectations and comparing the guidance from what was pushed through recently in the mid-month sales estimates and the guidance. The guidance is really going to be what you want to look for here. Of course, we want to see if they hit their numbers or not, but let's see what these companies are saying about the read-through for consumers and the activity in these various markets. So when we're looking at Home Depot, we want to hear what's happening with sales of certain goods and the trends and what Home Depot is seeing overall, because they are obviously seeing this, you know, right in real time, what's going on with not only the consumer and the retail, but also with the pros. You want to see what's happening with, for example, the Gap and Ross Stores. The Gap will tell you what's happening with, to an extent, what's happening with the younger set, kind of the, we'll call it under 40, generally speaking, under 40. This is what's happening with the clothing with under 40. And Ross is kind of like the next level up, right? Somewhere between, we'll call it, 35 to 60. The 35 to 60-year-olds, we'll be looking for bargains and shopping at Ross, et cetera. That's kind of the different situation going on with that. Aeropostale, A-R-O, has been really a problem for a long time. They also are going to be showing a loss, so they say it with the analysts say, about 58 cents per share. Sears is still bleeding, by the way. I don't even know what Sears is anymore. Remember some time ago that both JCPenney and Sears, but Sears was this major play. Kmart also. There's a few companies that had incredible amounts of property. In other words, they were bought all this property and this land, and they had their stores on it. And the underlying value of the land was being used in the calculation of the valuation of the company because we saw land prices in the mid-2000s going up so dramatically that these became real estate plays. And we know what happened after that, of course. They were only left to not only see the real estate valuation drop from under them, but also when we hit that recession, well, their sales moved lower too. It was a double whammy on these stores. Now, some of the good thing news is that obviously in the recovery, you saw both real estate prices move higher. And at the same time, you saw that sales get better. So that was good for these stores, but not for Sears entirely. Sears has kind of a, as I see it, an identity problem, just like JCPenney had. JCPenney went through that transition, that transformation from a bargain coupon slash budget-minded place where people would shop and get deals, and the deals were becoming fast and furious. Kind of like the Taco Bell of retail. Taco Bell seems to have a deal every day. Once a week, they come out with a new product. Amazing. Amazing how they can actually take the same ingredients and make it into a different product every single week. Have you ever thought of that with Taco Bell? How many ingredients they have? They don't have any differences in ingredients. They got a corn tortilla, a flour tortilla. They have meat. They have chicken. They have cheese. They have, and they keep on rolling it differently and molding it differently and cooking it a little slightly differently. They're going to fry this. They're not going to fry that. They're going to melt the cheese. They're not going to melt the cheese. They'll put beans in. It's all the same ingredients, and they keep on coming out with new products week after week after week. Every time you look at a Taco Bell commercial, new product. Now, I haven't eaten there, but I'm assuming that it pretty much all tastes about the same. Whether you get a the new burrito that's fried or the new burrito that's not fried or the new burrito that has the flour shell or the new burrito that has maybe a corn shell, who knows what it is. All tastes about the same. So Sears also has an identity problem, getting back to that, just like JCPenney does, where they were coming out with the deals and all that. But the difference is that Sears, while they were at one time a department store that specialized in certain areas, they had the best tools around for a long time, great appliances for a long time. Unfortunately, other players came into the market and took that away from them. No longer did they have the corner on those things. You know, you don't have the, you know, Craftsman tools were always great, and you saw that the Sears washers and dryers and the refrigerators were always top. Well, a lot of companies came in and now are the best in their breed, and no longer is Sears really seen as a place to go as the only go-to place for those. Clothing, when's the last time you bought clothes other than overalls or maybe carpenter pants, maybe work boots from Sears? I mean, unless it's the only place in town. When's the last time you did that? Now, I'm sure you maybe went there for tires. Maybe, hey, I need a battery for my car. Where am I going? I'm going to Sears. But clothes? And most of the store these days is clothes. Are you buying your dishes there? No. You know, there's a place like Bed Bath & Beyond. So all the components of what Sears was all about has been broken down. And it's been taken over by other companies. That's why they're doing so lousy. And they're unable to really turn that around because there's just no particular reason that you say that Sears is the only place to go for all this and that you'll do all your shopping there. We fragmented their overall, their business. We've taken their, well, not us, but other companies have taken their business and fragmented it. So if you know you're going to go, I need towels and I need bathroom accessories and I need a new KitchenAid mixer, where are you going? Maybe you're going to Bed Bath Beyond. I mean, you may be buying it online, but maybe you're going to go to Bed Bath & Beyond. And you say, hey, you know what? I need tools. Where are you going? Well, while I'm at Home Depot or Lowe's, I'll pick them up there. I don't really see a differential, and they have most of the same things anyway. Not that I'm going to get a bargain. So anyway, not to belabor the point, but the reason I'm bringing this up is to keep your eye out, your ears open, and your mind looking for these kind of situations where there's other companies that are coming into play and fragmenting another competitor's business. Very different than, for example, when Lowe's came in after Home Depot was there. One of the things that you have to admire about a second-in company, whereas one company like a Home Depot put all the other small hardware stores out of business in town, is that the second-in company takes a look at what the first guy did, looks at all the mistakes, the errors, the things that they could do better, the complaints that are being posed out there, and does their best to replicate everything that the first in is doing, but better. Trying to find the most efficient way to do what they're doing. Now, did Lowe's do it? I don't know. I'm not a big Lowe's guy. I'm much more, I prefer Home Depot for a lot of different reasons. But then again, maybe it's just because of what I buy and what I do there, etc. But think about that. You got the first in and second in. Second in usually has a big advantage. There's been many articles written, many studies done that there is a second in advantage. And it doesn't happen that often because, for the most part, markets aren't that large where you can really sustain major players like this. We haven't seen yet competition in Netflix, have we? Maybe Apple TV to a degree. Hulu, maybe. But that's more for TV shows. Amazon, with their movies, it's like the old Netflix. I don't know. I haven't been able to find anything good on Amazon Prime, where if you're an Amazon Prime member, you get all the different movies, etc., for free, supposedly. I don't know about you. I went on, and I saw a movie that I liked, and it cost like $5. I'm like, oh, what's that about? And by the way, last night I watched a movie. I went to, I was on Comcast, and I went and I kind of flicked through all the movies. I said, I'll watch that movie. I like that movie. It's Snow Drifter or Snow something or other. It was a story, it's a crazy story. It's about a guy who was leading a group of people that were all on a train. And they were on a train because the Earth froze over for various reasons in the future. And the only people left on Earth were all these people on a train that had the ability to withstand all the cold and just keep on traveling with no fuel forever. Okay, that's the movie. It was good, kind of entertaining to a degree. And it was $5.99 on Comcast. And just for the heck of it, I went on to Apple TV. It was $4.99. So just as a point of reference, you know, these companies are not all equivalent. They're offering different things. And I kind of go, I'm wandering a little bit here. But just trying to tell you all the different streams of consciousness that are going on right now in terms of what companies are doing. But the competition in terms of Comcast being essentially, you know, a monopoly for the most part, if that's all the cable that you have, has the benefit of saying, hey, we're going to charge more money. But the second in, like an Apple TV, can say, hey, we have high definition also. And if you want our product and, you know, we're going to give it to you maybe faster, better, give you more time to watch it in terms of movies. And we're also going to give you a cheaper price on it. So the second in, watch for that. Now, I can't really, there's no miraculous ending to this discussion where I'm going to tell you, oh, there's a great second in, this company that's going to be really just taken over in this area, and they're out there. But you'll find them. You'll find them out there. I mean, maybe there's another Starbucks lookalike coming out. Maybe there's another company that will be challenging Netflix one day, maybe. Maybe we're going to see a challenge to Tesla, which, by the way, Tesla had a great announcement last Friday. I thought it was fascinating. I got an email from Tesla. I get all their emails to their customers. Not that I'm a customer, but I get all their emails anyway somehow. And you may have gotten it too. What they said basically in a very eloquent manner was that they're going to be extending the warranty to make their warranty an unlimited mileage warranty on their Model S. They said, you know what, if we believe that our batteries are great and that the car and this and that, they're going through a whole bunch of things. And they said, well, if that's the case, we might as well just do an unlimited mileage warranty. And better than that, not only are we going to do it for people who buy cars today, but also we're going to do it retroactively to anyone that has purchased a car previously. Now, I'm not sure if anybody that's had work done is going to get a refund. That'd be kind of interesting. But Tesla also did say at the bottom of their note that by doing so, by giving this unlimited and by grandfathering in or making it retroactive to people who bought cars in the past, that what's going to happen is it's going to be a bit of a hit to earnings. It's going to be a few cents per share. We'll see on Monday, because this happened after the close on Friday. We'll see on Monday how that really affects the stock. Anyway, let's kind of get back to some of the more important things. Sorry, I wandered a little bit there, but I thought there was a lot of things going on that were very interesting. We had Mr. Money Mustache on recently, and I got to tell you something. There was a lot of emails that came on to me talking about both sides. I mean, there was some discussion that people were pretty pissed off and said, you know, what a waste of time. Why would I want to do something like that? Why would I want to save money and live meagerly and, you know, kind of go out there and do the things I want to do? That kind of email to, hey, wow, that was great and refreshing. So thanks for the emails. You can always write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll be happy to respond to you, and maybe even we'll have the opportunity to read a few if they are essentially important to talk about. But again, there's plenty of news that moved the markets last week. One of the things I thought was really interesting, and it was good to see, finally, that Coca-Cola did a deal with Monster Beverages. Now, there's a lot of components to this that are very interesting. First of all, why? Why? One of the things we do know is that Coca-Cola sales have kind of peaked, plateaued, and they're looking for ways to bring in more revenue, to expand their base. They have the distribution, no question about that. But how do they increase their revenue? Not with financial engineering, but with actual increase of revenue through new product entries. Maybe they're going to come out with a new Coca-Cola cherry. Maybe they have these new machines that we've seen in places like Chipotle and other restaurants where they have these unbelievable Coca-Cola machines that can give you any flavor in the world, essentially, or something that's never been thought of because you can mix it on your own. Okay, but they actually went out and they saw that the market for energy drinks has been continuing to do very, very well, growing substantially, and why not try to see if you could do a distribution deal with Monster and maybe as a test to see if you want to buy the company, because they bought, what did they buy? About 16 or 17% of the company for about $2.1 billion. So not only are they in a strategic partnership, but they own a big chunk of the company now. Shares were up about 30% on Friday of Monster. And I think there was a couple of reasons why. First, obviously, that Coca-Cola is not only putting money into them and they look at the valuation of it and you can then extrapolate what the value per share is for the company, but also realize that Monster is now going to be in a distribution deal with Coca-Cola, therefore gaining a lot more opportunity to increase their market share, get into a lot more stores, vending machines. This is going to be very, very good for them in terms of their potential revenue. And I think there's a third thing that hasn't been discussed very much. If you recall, for some time, there was a lot of discussion about the ill effects of energy drinks, right? There was all sorts of inquiries and government discussion about, are we going to regulate this industry? Is it negative for you? Is it causing problems? We had a time where the energy drink companies were just getting beaten up really, really substantially. With the news that there was, whether it was a death or an illness or something negative about this and the addiction problem, the young people drinking this, etc. And this was an ongoing theme for some time. And the companies in this industry were really getting hurt. So the third part of this deal, and the reason why Monster Beverage went up 30%, and by the way, full disclosure, we have a full position in the TDIMG Managed Growth Portfolio of Monster. We've been in and out of it for a while. We were short way back when there was some problems with the company, and then recently we had a long position, then we were out, and about 2.5-3 weeks ago, the position was added back to the core portfolio. So that was really nice. But the third reason is that now I think this gives a little more credence to the fact that energy drinks may not be as problematic from a health standpoint as was once thought. Would Coca-Cola pony up that kind of money to a company and have that much ownership of a company, add them to their distribution cycle if there was some real problem from a health standpoint? Now, you may say, oh, all these things have terrible health consequences. The high sugar in the Coke and the artificial things and flavors and when you look at the diet products, the various things that go in there as the fake sugars, and all these are bad. They rot your teeth. They discolor you. All these problems. So what the heck? They don't care. Well, I'll go with that. But I think also, though, that Coke is not going to be stupid enough to put that kind of money into a situation where they think there's going to be major legislation, at least from their perspective, on this due to some health issues. I think they've done their homework. They've done their checks. They've done all the work to find out, hey, is this something where we're going to have a real problem moving forward? There's a lot of money they put up. So I think this is a real win-win for both companies. And obviously, there's a lot of questions being asked like, okay, well, who's the next to be absorbed? Is there going to be, you know, and SodaStream keeps coming up. And they're now talking about going private. And SodaStream is a joke. I just don't think that that whole make your own soda thing is really going to be this really incredibly high growth, high profitability, long-term nature situation. We had that back when we make egg creams back in the 50s and 60s. And we've obviously gone to a mode where we want prepackaged, ready-to-go drinks and food, for that matter. So I'm not quite sure that's really going to be anything more than, you know, a fad. Now, it may be something that sticks around for a while, and it may be something that actually can make money for a while. But where do you go from there? They're talking about, well, we're going to have deals with restaurants. Why? Restaurants already have Coke machines and all that. Is it because customers are going to want to make their own soda? Is it going to be because you've come out with a new product somehow that's going to compete? What is the product? The product is just soda being mixed from carbonated water with a flavor. Well, hello. Isn't that what a fountain drink is already? And there's a lot of choices out there. And for the most part, you either see Pepsi or Coke in places. For the most part. So they have a major foothold in there already. And I just don't see how a SodaStream is going to really compete in that market. So take a look at this deal and think about what other companies could be, you know, looking to be absorbed. I mean, you got the water industry. We talked about this on DH Unplugged the week before. The increasing amount of bottled water that we drink in the United States. When I was a kid, you drank tap water. If you wanted good tap water, you drank tap water. If you wanted filtered water, you drank tap water. That's all there was. Now you go to a restaurant, you get a menu. Would you like natural water? Would you like sparkling water? Would you like bottled water? Would you like flavored water? No, I just want water. Now, how come they don't ask me about my ice? I always find that really interesting. They're going to give me bottled water because I prefer that, right? But then they put naturally tap water-based ice cubes in there. Well, what the heck? That's kind of stupid. What was the point of that? If they give me bottled water, might as well give me bottled ice water. Bottled ice, I mean, from a machine of some sort. Crazy. Anyway, the thing is that watch for these deals because many companies out there are looking to increase their revenue and they've really hit a wall. They've hit a wall because they're saturated around the world. These are the multinationals. And look for add-on or bolt-on deals where they're going to add to their distribution at a low cost. This is what's happening, by the way, in the healthcare industry. Exactly what's happening in the healthcare industry. You have a situation where companies have a great distribution platform. They're mature. They have a long list of drugs that they distribute. And if they fold in companies that have maybe either a drug that is coming to market or they fold in a company that has something that is in trials, and one of those trials hits, then the distribution is a no-brainer. What they do is they just put it on the list, they do their marketing, they send out their reps, and that distribution is immediate. So the companies that, and why it's good for them, we know, but it's also good for the other companies because they have been pretty much busy on the R&D, on the trials, on the regulation, on all the things that go into creating a drug, but maybe they don't have the need at this point for marketing. And by being absorbed by a major company, it's a win-win for both. Exactly what's going on with Monster Beverage. So you're going to see a lot more of this, and we've been seeing a lot of this already. I've been saying, why didn't Apple buy a Pandora, as an example? Why haven't we seen like a HomeAway be bought by Google? We saw that this Zillow and Trulia thing going to consolidate and they're going to combine. Zillow's buying Trulia. Real negative article in Barron's last week on this whole deal about saying they could drop about 60% and giving all the reasons why that is. And that's a little bit different because it's two companies that are similar, kind of just coming together. But these big boys that are looking for some kind of growth outside of their core, but yet close enough that it's not so difficult to create an add-on to the current business that just is a very easy flow-through. So, for example, look at a VMware. I mean, look at, you know, being bought by somebody. Or look at For example, Salesforce. You know, IBM, or better yet, Microsoft. Microsoft has their own version of a CRM system. Basically, what they have is their Outlook and a few other things. It's not so great, in my opinion. But when you look at Salesforce, which is this contact management and relationship management system, what you have is something that seems like an easy opportunity for Microsoft to pick up. It may take longer. They may try a lot of times to do it themselves and fail at it because there are others that specialize. And then one day they break down. They say, you know what? We're going to take a piece of it. That's the thing. Watch for them taking pieces of these companies. Now, around the world, there's been a tremendous amount of news that we need to pay attention to. Now, we do know that there has been this whole war worry going on and the concern about what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. And Russia looks like they're not backing down. They look like they're helping. They're not helping and all this. What the real problem there is that you're seeing that the European markets and the Eurozone overall are really starting to feel the pressures of the sanctions and the problems with Russia. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about how this whole idea of sanctions and penalties is going to be very problematic if they really start ratcheting them up, because they're going to turn around and actually hit us negatively, but more so they're going to hit Europe negatively. And already we're seeing that with the in Germany in particular. Germany, as we talked about last week, is probably the largest amount of trade of any country when it comes to Russia. And that's a problem. We've seen their markets drop dramatically. We've seen that their confidence numbers, the investor confidence numbers, have slipped tremendously. As a matter of fact, investor confidence in Germany declined for an eighth month as this whole thing is going on with Ukraine, and a sluggish euro-era recovery is dampening the outlook for Europe's largest economy. Last week, the ZOO Investor Expectations Index, which this is aiming to, I guess, predict economic developments 6 months in advance, dropped to 8.6 from 27.1 in July. In 1 month, it dropped again. Now, economists have forecast a decrease to 17, so this is way under at 8.6. And this particular investor confidence number has actually slipped every month since it read a 7-month high back in December. So the whole euro area, and that was just Germany, the investor expectation index dropped to 23 from 48. And that's the lowest since December of 2012. Now, this is with Italy going back into a recession, GDP in Germany unexpectedly dropping, and the fact that there is no stopping or no end in sight, really, to this whole Ukraine issue. Now, there has been a lot of last-minute news that has come out at the 1, 2, 2:30 hour that seems to help markets. As a matter of fact, on Friday, markets dropped pretty good into the early morning after the news came that there's been additional amounts of fighting and, again, more troops on the border lines. And this was becoming a real big problem and then seemed to go away. And then Friday, all of a sudden, whoop, there it goes again. We have all of a sudden the same thing happening again. Markets took a quick move. Within about 15 minutes, they were up about 5 on the S&P to down about 8 or 9. And then they kind of moved higher throughout the day as investors said, hey, who cares? This will be over soon, right? We also saw a bunch of Fed speakers come out in the afternoon, make some comments. Kachalakara came out. He made some comments that were very dovish. Bullard came out with his old, you know, same thing about dissension and looking at that we're going to increase rates. But overall, the whole idea was that there was a variety of central banks, again on Friday, coming out because the big concern is, oh my gosh, if there's a war, it's going to hurt, you know, the economy and the stock markets. And the Fed is so focused in on that, and the central banks are so tuned into that, that they want to just simply make sure that they could talk it up using their quote-unquote communication tools, propaganda. to talk up the markets. And markets reacted very well, as a matter of fact, to the unchanged territory for the S&P. Dow was down a bit. NASDAQ was slightly up. And that is amazing in the fact that we did see the news escalate on Friday and such a drop. And we also saw, like I said, retail sales move lower and a couple of negative numbers overall on the economics last week. The idea, again, once again, is that we're going to see that as economics get soft, the idea is going to be that the Fed's going to come in with more stimulus or maybe slow down their bond buying cuts. In other words, they may extend it out a little bit or hold interest rates at the same levels, no increase, for even a longer period of time. Well, we'll see how that plays out because next week we have some important things coming out in terms of economics. So we have, for example, we have the CPI coming out. Always right after the PPI comes out, the producer price index, which is the wholesale level of inflation, if you will. Well, we have the consumer inflation coming out. Expectations are from last month where we had a plus 0.3% reading, it's going to drop to a plus 0.1% reading on the headline number. Now, if we take out food and energy, and remember something, that energy has come down in price over the last month pretty significantly. Food prices also came down a bit. We're looking at that actually moving higher, which is interesting. So if we take out food and energy on a month-over-month basis, where it was 0.1% last month, it's going to be ratcheting up to 0.2%. And on a year-over-year basis, looking at a 2%, which is the number that is really the line that you want to look at, what the inflation rate is. And then on the 19th, we also have housing starts coming out. Now, you remember something, there was a weird thing that happened. You know, everybody was expecting a decent number last month, and all of a sudden it dropped. It was down 9% on a month-over-month basis. The expectations are for that to snap back. Of course, we always look for a snapback. You know, if we see a big number, we never think, oh, it's going to drop down because it's going to, you know, offset, and it was just great. Nope. Well, eternally optimistic, these economists. And we saw a negative 9.3%, and we're looking for a plus 8.4% this month. Round number, building permits at 1 million. That's up from last month, which was 963,000. And that's an increase of about 2.8% where we saw about a 4.5% drop last month. More importantly, on the 20th, we're going to be seeing the Fed releasing their minutes from their July 29th through their 30th meeting. So that's always a day that has a lot of excitement into it because the idea is that, hey, the Fed's going to do everything they can. This is the new Fed, of course. They're going to do everything they can to boost up the markets, and why not buy into it? So I would see that going into that particular release at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the 20th, you're going to see that there's going to be some excitement and probably some push towards that moving markets higher. See initial jobless claims in the 300,000 range on Thursday. Also looking at the Philly Fed business outlook, which is expected to be about 19, down from about 23. And then finally, on the 21st, we're going to see the leading index, which is expected to be 0.6 versus 0.3 last month, and existing home sales at about the 5 million mark on an annualized basis. A slight drop on a month-over-month basis from last month of about down 1% from last month, something like that. So those are things we're looking at during next week. I'm going to be also watching what's going on with crude because WTI crude broke 96 for a short time last week. And then with the announcement and the realization of news that there's something more going on in Russia and Ukraine and all that, obviously it went up on Friday and oil prices are very much, looking at what's going on in that region because they're very sensitive to that and that whole region. And with that, we'll see how this is going to play out because on one hand, inventory levels are very high. One of the big things is that we've seen that due to the fact that U.S. is really producing a tremendous amount of oil, it's been very good for inventories, and that should generally have an effect on oil prices, obviously with supply and demand. But also, we're also seeing that, obviously, consumption of gas is down. It's getting past the summer months where things usually peak out. And we're in the middle of it, but getting towards the end of it. And on top of that, we see that inventories are very good. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. less consumption is not necessarily good. People are not traveling, not doing things, are staying home, and that's not usually very good for overall consumer spending. Does that mean that people are really slowing down on their purchases, not only of gas, but they're also slowing down on purchase of other things? Well, yes, we have seen that. Is it at a point that's critical? No, not yet. But there is some kind of indication that consumers are slowing down. On the other hand, you also have to look at the efficiency of cars, the electric vehicles that are on the market, the hybrids that are on the market, the cars that have higher fuel efficiency. Is that also going into this whole calculation that's showing that we have less of a demand for fuel, not that we're traveling less, but less of a demand because there's higher efficiency? That's an interesting thing. You know, if you really think about this, if we have a tremendous amount of fuel that we are able to find, explore, and then dig up from the ground in the United States, more than we've had ever before, and if, in fact, not only does that make us independent in terms of our fossil fuels, but also makes us a major participant, thereby relieving the pressure and concern that we're going to have X amount of years of oil from the Middle East and then it runs out and where do we go from there? That's why we need all these alternative fuels, and we need to make sure the not only from a environmental standpoint, but also from, you know, obviously an energy, long-term energy standpoint, where we need to have the energy in order to make things run. Now, if in fact we have a good amount of energy here and we are being able to convert that and very well in a cost-efficient manner, and we don't have the worry about oil running out, well, you have a supply-demand situation there. We're just clearly giving you the benefit of lower prices. The big question of whether that's actually occurring right now. Because you really do see that we have the Middle East having some tensions there. Nothing's really gone away with that. OPEC hasn't changed anything recently. We're seeing that the Russia situation, even with all that's going on, even Brent and WTI have dropped dramatically over the last few weeks. Yeah, it did kick up a little bit on Friday, but still dropped pretty well. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe all this is playing out to the fact that all of the energy exploration that's been going on, the alternative fuels have been really paying off, and we're going to see fuel drop, oil prices drop even further. It's very possible. And that actually would be very good for the economy. That would be good for consumers. That would be good for spending, because discretionary spending will fire up very nicely. So this is something I'm going to be watching over the next. I have it on my watch list, if you will, right on my screen. I'm going to watch oil, major issue there. I'll also tell you that gold and silver have not really been doing anything. Even with the last month's reading of the CPI increasing, yes, it did in fact push it higher. And with all of the geopolitical imbalances going on, you would think that there would be some kind of a move towards buying gold. But each time it's popped up for a few days, there's been some sellers that have been attacking that. Now, gold is above $1,300 per ounce, and silver is right on its support line. Where do we go from here? Will we have inflation next week? Is there going to be concerns? Will people use gold and silver as a proxy for risk to put money into that as opposed to maybe stocks or bonds? And I think finally we have to really think about what's going on with the U.S. bond yields. Do you know that in Germany, the yields are less than or right at 1% for a 10-year? We're at 2.45 or so on the 10-year here. That means German bonds are safer than U.S. bonds? Really? But again, this big need for yield, this big chase for yield, and this run to find anything that yields something is pretty amazing. And where's the money coming from? A lot of it's coming from the fact that there's negative deposit rates in Europe, and there's really no place for banks to put their money if they want to earn any interest. It used to be easy to get some money right from the central bank. Now they can't even get that. They got to pay if they leave money at the central bank. So why not go to the countries out there that have bonds for sale and buy as much as they can, especially if they're local? And that's what's happened. We've seen that the Euro region, even though many of the countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal have a lot of problems, their bonds are being bought at an incredible rate. And the reason for that is, and we've talked about this, that one of the things that Draghi left out from his recent ECB conversation was that, well, we're going to do everything, but we're leaving out bond buying. We're leaving out buying asset-backed securities right now. Well, we may buy it soon. We may come back to this. But right now, we'll leave it on the sidelines. And I talked about this, why that is and what the reason is. But this is really interesting because it leaves the door open for him to come in if things don't do well, and they're not doing well, by the way, to come up with some plan, even though it's probable that it would be very convoluted due to the fact of their limitations of what they can do in buying bonds of specific countries as a central bank, because they have many different countries there, different than what we have here, obviously. And if that's the case, the idea is that, well, why not buy bonds over there? Because we're going to have an absolute large-scale buyer coming into this market eventually. And therefore makes it kind of safe. Makes it that there's going to be essentially a put. You can't really worry about it because how far can they go the other direction if we're going to see that an asset-backed security program, buying program, or quantitative easing is going to be put in place in Europe. That's what's going on with their bonds. I don't think it's going to work out as a lot of people are thinking. I do not think that there's going to be the same kind of bond buying that went on in the U.S. to the degree that it went on with the same effect. Already they ran way ahead of it anyway. How much lower can they go? How much more can an ECB bond buying program really affect the yields if their 10-year is 1%? Are we going to see Japan-like yields? Is this the new age of just artificially pushing down yields forever? Maybe. But there's going to be somewhere a kink in this whole situation that's going to bring it all down because it's not natural. It's not open markets. It's not efficient markets. It's not the essence of what a market is to hold down rates artificially, to buy into those kind of things as a government, because obviously the government has a lot more, if not unlimited amounts of money that they could spend. That doesn't create a true valuation of the bonds, of markets. It's not a free market environment. And that can't last forever. Now, will it last 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? Yes, potentially. Can it go on for some time? Yes. But there's an end game here when things have to unravel a bit. Even if these countries allow their bonds just to run off naturally, there's a vacuum in there of buyers at the level that they've been buying previously. Now, our bonds, amazingly, have not seen a tick up in yield. Matter of fact, they've gone down since the $85 billion program was going on to where we are now. How is that? Who's filling that gap? If the Fed was the majority in a really big way of holding and buying of U.S. debt, and they stop buying, who's buying? All of a sudden, magically, everybody's buying? Maybe it's other countries. I mean, if you can get a yield at 1% in Germany and get 2.5% for the same 10-year in U.S., well, maybe the U.S. is a better deal. Kind of an interesting phenomenon if you really think about it, and why markets are seeing very little fear. That's why the VIX came down dramatically again last week after flying up, 30% the week before. Because essentially the realization is that at the end of the day, the Fed's going to be here. So they said. So they've been doing. Their actions say it. Their words say it. But there's going to be a time that's not going to be the case. And that's when things are going to get, it's going to hit the fan. Let's put it that way. And that's why, by the way, just to circle all the way around here, that's why we're looking at gold is still a good potential place to be. as long as it stays above its support level. And clearly it's been holding above the 1300, been dipping down a little bit, but then coming right back up. And silver, which has been bleeding a little bit, still has an opportunity as a precious metal and as a place for some money in a portfolio as we see it. So anyway, lots of movement around today, kind of free thinking, free thought. Sorry about that. A lot of movement from one place to another. Hopefully you kept up with me in this open and free thinking that I've been doing. If you have any questions, of course, you can ask me anytime. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you want more information about the Aero strategy or the TDI MG managed growth strategy or the global allocation strategies that we manage for clients, just go to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You'll find it all there. You can find out anything you need to know and more. And of course, make sure to listen to us on iTunes and subscribe there. Tell your friends about it. And other than that, we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.